case, which is Young versus Circus Circus Casinos, case number 70551. I know all of you gentlemen, but if you wouldn't mind, when you approach, could you please state your name for my clerk if any parties are with you? And at this point, I'll ask Mr. Benham, how many minutes do you need for rebuttal argument? Very well, that will be the order. So whenever you're ready to proceed, please approach.
And, Your Honor, I'm Sam Benham on behalf of the appellant, and with me today is Mr. Stephen Burris, also on behalf of the appellant and attorney. So let me go ahead and get started. And I want to say first, the facts in this case really can be pretty simply stated. Elevator handrail was not securely fastened to an elevator wall, and when plaintiff Jason Young leaned on that elevator handrail, the handrail detached from the wall, causing him to twist and injure his back. It was plaintiff's burden to show that defendants fell below the standard of care by not maintaining the handrails in the elevators properly. Defendant's defense was basically they had no actual or constructive notice the handrails were loose and hazardous, or that they were being adequately inspected and maintained. To present their defense, defendants were allowed to elicit self-serving testimony from a number of their employees claiming the elevator handrails were always safe because they were doing a terrific job making sure they were always in tip-top condition. The trial court allowed defendants to present their case with little or no limitations. Unfortunately, the playing field was not even for the plaintiffs. Rather, during trial, the trial court committed two prejudicial errors that basically handcuffed plaintiff from presenting the most critical facts of their case and then instructed the jury to disregard what little they did have on the standard of care and the failure to meet it. The trial court's first error was its decision to preclude plaintiff from being able to present relevant evidence that would have shown defendant's so-called, quote, daily inspections, unquote, were a sham and did not prevent the handrails from becoming and remaining loose. The trial court's second error was its decision to instruct the jury that it could not consider the standard of care testimony from plaintiff's elevator expert, but it could consider the same testimony from all of defendants' witnesses and experts. Again, plaintiffs just wanted an even playing field, and they were not given one. The jury received the impression that we, the plaintiff, had nothing to show them, and what we did show them, the court later instructed them to, in effect, ignore.
Well, I noticed in your briefing, one of the issues on appeal was that you were precluded from presenting evidence of subsequent conditions through your expert, through these other elevators that were inspected, so to speak. I have a question on that particular issue that was raised. I noticed that on the record on appeal on 0061, bait stamped, that Commissioner Chris Beecroft had actually issued a recommendation as the discovery commissioner. And I noticed that during the argument with respondent's attorneys, not this attorney, but a different attorney, the elevator's attorney. The court ultimately granted that recommendation and that court order that said no discovery shall be done on any other elevators prior to trial and issued this as irrelevant. District court signed off on that. So the respondents were operating under that particular order, and they objected at trial then to the subsequent conditions. Why or what's your best argument that it could be an abuse of discretion by the district court by precluding that evidence when the discovery commissioner had already made those recommendations in the order?
Well, one on the discovery commissioner's recommendation, Your Honor, that was an order in discovery. And when our expert went and inspected the elevators, he was in the same bank. It's not like he went all over Circus Circus and inspected all the elevators. He stayed in the same bank. I believe there's six elevators in that bank. They're all basically the same handles in that. So that was a discovery report and recommendation. And as Your Honor knows, discovery rules are different than evidentiary rules. I mean, sure, you can say on the one hand they're a little broader, maybe much broader than evidence, But that was not a final evidentiary ruling that the discovery commissioner, Beecroft, issued. And our expert, when he was at...
God bless you.
When he was at Circus Circus, he did look in these other elevators. There were loose handles. And so he did have firsthand knowledge.
Well, but our standard review here is abuse of discretion, meaning the district court has some discretion to balance things. And we all know that, you know, what's probative versus what's prejudicial can sometimes be a delicate thing. But in order for us to reverse that, we have to find that the district court acted unreasonably in its balancing test. And in this case, the inspection of the elevators happened 2 years ago. So why wouldn't the district court have been within its discretion to say that's way too long for it to be... not that it would have been irrelevant, but the probative value is much smaller than the possible risk of confusion or irrelevance at that stage. Why isn't that a discretionary call for it to make?
Your Honor, I agree it's a discretionary call for the district court to make. And I agree with the balancing that you set forward. But I think the abuse of discretion starts when we were not even allowed to lay the foundation to allow the court to exercise its discretion that the elevators were in the same condition, it was the same handles. And so even though there's a 2-year difference in time, there is Nevada case law that allows, if the circumstances are shown to be similar, then evidence that's taken after the fact to show an existing condition can come in. So I think.
And what specific case is that?
Is that Wade versus Hayes or a different case?
It was... court's indulgence.
Sure.
This would be the Wade v. Hayes case, Your Honor, and that's it. 89 Nevada 375, 513 P. Second 1222. So I think that where you started there with the abuse of discretion is not even allowing us the chance to say, Your Honor, let us at least explain why we believe this is similar. And even in the Hayes case, even though the evidence ultimately didn't come in, it was a slot machine door, the court was going to allow the evidence to come in, but then they couldn't get the circumstances similar, and the court changed its mind. It said, no, we can't allow this to come in now. So, if I move to the second prejudicial error now, and this would be involve the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Stephen Carr. And there were medical experts in this case as well, but they're not part of this appeal. But, Dr. Carr is an engineering elevator expert. He's testified on numerous occasions regarding elevator safety and those type issues. And Dr. Carr is someone who defense counsel, Ms. Mastrangelo, the elevator attorney, she's very familiar with him. I mean, they cross paths constantly mm-hmm. because that's a narrow area that they're involved in. And Dr. Carr was deposed at length in this case, and the elevator attorney knew well ahead of time just exactly what he was going to say. But when he got on the stand, she told the trial court that she was, in effect, surprised by his testimony, and she could not have made appropriate motions in limine beforehand to limit his testimony, and the trial court bought into all of this. Ms. Mastrangelo even had a case, I think it's an unpublished case from about 4 years ago from a...
Michigan
case, yes, Your Honor. And mid-trial, the district court or the trial court disallows most of Dr. Carr's proffered testimony and then later told the jury to disregard the expert's opinions on standard of care. The jury had been impressed with that because it would view this as a plaintiff cannot back up what was said in opening, and then the court's telling the jury to disregard our one and only engineering expert and therefore listen and trust the defendant's witnesses only. Again, this is not the level playing field that we believe we should be entitled to when we go to trial. These are things that are...
Wasn't it just as to the frequency of inspections that they were to disregard? It wasn't just to disregard his whole testimony, though.
It was, Your Honor. And I can address that now because the court told the jury, disregard his standard of care regarding frequency inspections, but you can believe everybody else about this. And what I would submit, this is a confusing instruction. It's rather vague to the jury. And I would say if you tell jurors, you say disregard the standard of care just to frequency, the subtlety, the legal subtlety of that is going to be missed on the jurors. They're going to say, well, the judge said to disregard this guy's opinion on the standard of care.
Did you proffer below to the trial judge another limiting instruction to be, you know, during formal instructions?
During the formal instruction.
So I realize the transcript is the judge just giving an oral limiting instruction, but because your argument is that it was very confusing, did you or your side proffer an actual written instruction to be given to the jury at the close of the evidence prior to deliberation?
We did not do a specific instruction like that, Your Honor, and I think probably the problem with that was how to compose an instruction that would tell the jury to, you can go ahead and believe this witness now on the standard of care. It's almost an instruction that would be going to the credibility of a specific witness if you put that in a jury instruction form. And the instruction to the jury, and if we get in this, I know Your Honor's familiar, it's in the brief, it's a common carrier instruction, mm-hmm. and that talks about the heightened standard of mm-hmm. care. But I'm saying if you tell a jury, disregard this guy's standard of care testimony, that's the one expert we have, he's the only one that can testify on that, and sure, there's, you know, a standard of care on this, there's a standard of care on that, and the jury is going to hear standard of care, we don't have to pay attention to this guy. And then to compound the error on that, the judge says, but you can do with whatever you want. Anybody else that testified on the standard of care, you can believe their testimony, but you must not consider his.
You're right. I'll give you some more time on the clock. I'll give you 4 minutes because of my asking a question, but you're at 3 minutes right now, so I wanted to let you know that you've got rebuttal argument.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
And unfortunately, I can't talk real fast, but I will do my best. Let me...
Did you want... Because your time is up right now on your opening argument. I will give you 4 minutes... in rebuttal after respondent, if you would like? Or would you rather finish your whole argument now and not rebut?
You know what, Your Honor, I think I better save it for rebuttal.
Thank you. Very well. We'll hear from respondent.
May it please the court, Troy Payton appearing on behalf of respondent Circus Circus. I guess to go back and talk about the first issue first, where we're dealing with this, these conditions of the elevators in the Dr. Carr looked at it 2 years after the fact, is I think that the law in Nevada is very clear that subsequent incidents or subsequent conditions are not admissible to prove notice of a
subsequent hazard. Conditions or subsequent accidents?
Well, I think it's both. It would be I would read that in as both in the Rheingold case because they're kind of one and the two one and the same thing.
Right, but you could see how the district court could think there would be substantial prejudice if there were other accidents brought in. The jury might focus on the accidents versus just an inspection showing a condition.
Well. And yes, Your Honor, that is correct, but we also have the idea that certainly any time that you have the accident, it would necessarily, there would be a similar condition, and that's what we
Well, but,
at.
I mean, the problem with that, I mean, granted, in this case, it's 2 years later, which is essentially your time, but everything's going to be subsequent, right? An accident happens, even if the expert comes in later the same day, he's still technically looking at the condition subsequent to the actual accident, right?
Yes.
You're just talking about degrees of how much time has elapsed.
Yes, that's right. But But typically, the whole point of it is when they are is when any plaintiff is making the argument that you had a that you have notice, whether it be actual or constructive notice of a potentially hazardous condition, you know, you're going to look at it's what how it was after the fact does not go to is certainly not relevant to notice of how things were before the accident and whether that should have given actual or constructive notice.
Even if it's 5 seconds after the accident, just because it's afterwards, that's you're saying that's not relevant to what the to any notice that occurred right before the accident that occurred like 5 seconds earlier?
Well, I think 5 seconds maybe we're getting where that's almost instantaneous, but I think that the whole idea is whether we had is whether if there is notice, whether it be like I said, the actual or constructive notice.
What about in their rebuttal case, though? Because that may very well be true for their case in chief as far as were they on notice. But now you put on a defense of this is a freak accident, you know, this has never happened, whatever. And why wouldn't it become relevant in their rebuttal case to show that it's not a freak accident? This is the way Circus rolls with their elevators.
Well, two things is one, Judge. I think it's important to remember the type of incident or type of occurrences was this wasn't a matter of the of a Mr. Young taking a hold of the rail and it being a little wobbly and that caused him to stumble. The rail itself detached from the wall. So that I think that's a very big difference between when you're looking at something later and you're finding a wobbly, maybe a little loose rail 2 years later. Now I think we'd be having a whole different conversation if Dr. Card said even 2 years after the fact I walked into those elevators and I was leaning on these things were detaching from the wall. You know that there we've got like I said that becomes a whole. A different thing, but today, what we're talking about is a loose handrail on an elevator. And I think something else is when we're talking about subsequent versus prior incidents. It's important to remember that there was, and it was before the jury, a prior incident of this very handrail 6 weeks before the incident being discovered. Being loose, and that the ThyssenKrupp technician tightened that handrail. So I think the idea that there was no evidence, or somehow the plaintiff was hamstrung by showing what happened, or that our policies and procedures weren't good. Well, you know, sometimes the evidence just isn't good. But the evidence that was before the jury and was unrefuted and undisputed is the fact that. The prior incident, what would give the hotel notice of a problem, that these prior incidents were being discovered as evidenced by the ThyssenKrupp employee, the technician, 6 weeks before the incident, finding and tightening this handrail. So I will say, too, is that, like I said, this is not a, it's not a common occurrence. I will say it may be common that there are, that a handrail can become loose. We probably all had that experience of getting into an elevator and finding something a little wobbly. But the idea of something where the handrail absolutely detached from the wall, and that's what happened, is it wasn't wobbly, it detached from the wall without a lot of force either. It just came off and detached from the wall. That certainly wasn't a common occurrence. That certainly what that hazard is. You know, I suppose you could say we would probably have stipulated at trial. Could you know have we ever had wobbly handrails before? Certainly, and we had one 6 weeks before. But as far as this being a common occurrence, which we weren't being which we weren't taking any actions to prevent, that was certainly not the case. The Way versus Hayes case, I would submit, does not support the appellant's proposition. Way involved a courtroom demonstration, which the trial judge found wasn't substantially similar to the way that it occurred. Certainly if Dr. Carr had been asking or, had gone into court to try to somehow do a demonstration of this, maybe that case would be a little more on point.
What do you think, Mr. Payton, about the appellant's characterization that there was not a level playing field as to both inspections and as to the standard of care, and that essentially the plaintiff's case below was cut apart during trial, and yet the defense was able to almost run wild? I mean, it didn't use those words, but the idea is it was like, you know, dramatically different on what the two sides were able to do, and unexpectedly, because it happened during trial.
Well, and I think that, Your Honor, maybe there isn't always a level playing field at trial, because some cases are just better than others, and I would submit that we had a better case that had nothing to do with what the district court was, you know, what they did to the plaintiff's case. The idea that the, again, you've got this incident that occurred 2 years, or these this inspection that occurred 2 years after the incident, that was a, I think, like I said, I think the district court judge summed it up pretty well, where he says, you know, I don't want the jurors to jump to the conclusions that since other elevator handrails at other points and times after this accident, that those might have been loose, that somehow is evidence as to what Circus or ThyssenKrupp had knowledge of before the accident here. And I, like I said, I think when we look at that issue, he did not abuse, certainly I don't think he abused his discretion in, you know, as far as balancing probative value versus unfair prejudice. As far as any other, like I said, I think
what about that standard of care part? So that the appellant has characterized it in two different ways, both what happened with the inspections evidence and what happened with the opinions about standard of care.
Okay. Yes, what happened is during the course of trial, Dr. Carr started to testify as to the frequency, how often you should inspect. At that point, counsel for Thyssen objected. We went outside the presence of the jury. Basically, Dr. Carr admitted that there's no code requirement setting forth a standard frequency of inspection. There's nothing in a manual that says that, and he doesn't have the experience there's nothing in his experience which would support that. And these are all admissions by Dr. Carr, and the district court excluded only his frequency of inspection opinions. And in fact, actually, as we look in the transcript, basically after he tells the jury, and what he's telling the jury is not to, you know, that the frequency of inspections is opinions are what's out, and then
his wording is a little odd when you read it, Judge Scott. He appears to be almost flustered as he's talking.
Well, and Your Honor, I guess what I would say is he tells the jury he gives his instructions to the jury. Mr. Burris says, you know, I want to make clear, you're striking his opinion on how often you're supposed to inspect it. The jury can still consider all the other evidence, like what the employees at Circus said, correct?
And did in fact, in closing argument, did counsel reaffirm that instruction that did he go over everything that expert said as far as standard of care other regards?
As far as I recall, Your Honor, but then after that concern about expressed by counsel about what was said, the court goes on and clears it. Let me clarify that I'm only striking the opinion testimony of Dr. Carr that you heard. I'm not striking anyone else's testimony. I do want to make that clear, so give the testimony whatever weight you deem it necessary. However, there is no expert testimony on how frequently the handrails must be inspected, and you're not to consider any prior testimony of this incident on the issue of whether they breached the duty of care on the frequency of inspection. Frequencies of inspections are out of your mind, but if anyone testified, you can consider it. So basically, as far as this unlevel playing field, is what we had is simply what was excluded were Dr. Carr's observations of what he saw 2 years after the fact and this frequency of inspection. Ruling, and as far as that, like I said, in I think I've, and I briefed this as well, that if anything that was this was the court's clarification, the last word that he gave on this came at the request of Mr. Burris. I suppose if Mr. Burris had any thought that that was somehow also confusing, he could have made another request for clarity, but it ended at that, and the trial went on. So, Judge, as far as the end level playing field, I think that's really a bit of an unfair characterization that we were allowed to put in everything we wanted. And although those aren't there's nothing apparently too outrageous because that
did even object.
Yeah, because we're not talking about it today.
Well, what about is his experience long, Dr. Carr's experience? Is that enough? Just his experience to opine as to frequency? I mean, these are very specialized experts in the field of common carriers, elevators, escalators. I mean, there's only a couple nationally. I think they go all over, and I've had one of those cases when I was a district court judge. And so you end up getting the same experts all the time. Why isn't that just their expertise enough to opine under Hallmark as to frequency?
I think it may be, but Your Honor, one of the things that this was not argument that he didn't have the experience, these came as admissions from Dr. Carr himself that he didn't have experience on frequency for inspection. And I think another thing too is it's important to keep in mind is that this is an unusual occurrence. That there's a lot of other things where an elevator you may get a 4-foot drop or something, and they would be opining about various things in that. But the idea of inspecting a handrail, that's even if you are testifying all over the country, you're not going to be dealing with that a lot, I would say. The only thing I would say too on the common carrier, the idea that somehow that there should have been a motion for a new trial on the common carrier issue is, the standard of review, as the court's aware, is that as a matter of law, the jury could not have reached a verdict in favor of Circus Circus without manifestly disregarding the instructions and that common carrier instruction. And I would submit that basically we had put in a lot of evidence as far as what we did, how we maintained and inspected this, that we had a contract, Circus had a contract with ThyssenKrupp. Diane Morgan, the risk manager for Circus Circus, testified about the housekeepers. They would clean, they would report if there was any problems for any employee. There's a see something, say something problem if you think there's a problem. And Aaron Nelson, the former assistant chief engineer of Circus Circus, says there's no written policy, but it's certainly not confusing what they did. If the ThyssenKrupp technician was present and there was a problem, they would have him or her fix it. If the technician was not there and engineering could fix it, engineering would fix it. If engineering couldn't fix it, then the engineering department would then take the elevator out of service and call under ThyssenKrupp. Again, I think the sufficiency of how we did things and is supported by the idea that there was a similar problem a week or 6 weeks before, and they found it and they fixed it. It was not based on speculation.
Thank you, Mr. Payton, for your argument.
Thank you.
We'll just hear the final 4 minutes of the appellant's rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me first touch on the frequency of inspection. And that was the whole defense. And by knocking Dr. Carr out, we had no way to present a case. And the frequency of inspection, if you take that, where they're saying they inspect every day, their witnesses also said it takes weeks to months for these screws to come so loose the rail would come off. And yet, it came off. So the fact that Dr. Carr could have gone in and said, no, if they're doing the same procedures today, which they said they were, these rails are loose, and they shouldn't be loose if they're doing that, we could at least rebut that. This was to try and...
And they didn't file a motion in limine because Ms. Mastriani, I'm going to say her name wrong,
Mastriangelo,
she did not file a motion in limine in this case to preclude testimony regarding frequency.
Correct, Your Honor. And yet, she was waiting in the wings with the four-year-old case to attack that during the trial. And as far as Dr. Carr's knowledge, I believe Your Honor is correct. His experience gives him knowledge in this area. Admittedly, there's no codes saying that this elevator you have to inspect once a month, this elevator you have to inspect once a year. But Dr. Carr has extensive knowledge in this area. He's been qualified as an expert. Ms. Mastrangelo did not question his qualifications as an expert, and that's one of the hallmark considerations, is what type of experience does this person have? Not everything has written treatises on every single issue.
Except for, I mean, handrails, like you said, if it's a four-foot drop, they're used to testifying about that. Being stuck in an elevator, they're probably used to testifying about that. But what can you point to that shows that he was familiar with handrails or loosening of handrails?
He's familiar with how the elevator is supposed to be constructed and maintained. He's familiar with the how the elevator is engineered, and that includes the attachment of devices within the elevator that need to withstand more stress than just say a decorative handrail, because elevator handrails have heavy use, they undergo vibration all the time.
Well, but under Hallmark, the expert's opinion has to be based on reliable methodology. It's not enough to say he knows a lot of stuff, because you know a lot of people know stuff, but there has to be some sort of metric for measuring, does this guy know enough to testify in a way that's meaningful, right?
And I agree, Your Honor, but I guess with, and I don't have a CV in front of me, but 20, 30 years experience in the industry and knowing about inspecting elevators for safety and that, I think that he would have enough other than just he knows his stuff like that.
Did you have in your disclosures, in any of your, in the expert witness report, in this doctor, is it Dr. Carr, did he opine as to frequencies of an inspection in his expert report?
Your Honor, I cannot specifically say yes or no. I do know he opined on frequency of inspection during his deposition, and he was questioned extensively about that during his deposition. So did he give an opinion in the report? I can't say for certain. Did he give an opinion in his deposition? I can say, but yes, he did.
Is that in the record, too, the deposition? Is that on the record on appeal? I mean, we basically get your trial transcripts.
I do not believe Dr. Carr's deposition.
And I don't remember reading that, what you just said. I don't remember reading that in the briefs.
I believe in the appendix to the briefs that, and in the argument between the court, Ms. Mastrangelo, about all of this, that there, she does reference during his deposition, she's asked him about this.
I don't remember seeing that to the district court, but I'll take a look again.
But his deposition transcript.
Thank you so much for your arguments. This case will stand submitted, and we will be in recess.